All right, everybody would take their seats, quiet down. We've got a long agenda. We'll try to get through it. Representative Siders removes the minutes of the March 23rd meeting. Any additions, corrections, or anything like that? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Chair will move House File 3484 be recommended to pass and refer to the Jobs Committee. You got to go back for the finance, right?
Correct.
Representative Westerberg? Okay. The bill is moved. You can address your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 3484, seeks to reestablish the Boxing Commission here in the state of Minnesota. And members, this commission was eliminated here a while back in an attempt to, we're in a cost-saving mode, and we're trying to reduce some of the budget. And it appeared that there wasn't going to be a substantial need for the Boxing Commission here in the state of Minnesota because the National Federation of Boxing, the American Boxing Council, had an agreement where they would sanction bouts here in Minnesota. However, that has since changed. Due to liability changes in the industry, they have ceased to do that, and so if we are going to have bouts here in Minnesota, we have to have our own commission here in order to sanction and organize and regulate this industry. And that's what this bill is attempting to do, is simply reestablish the commission that we had prior here in the state of Minnesota. With that, members, I have a testifier here. I just would like to give you a little bit of his background here. He's fought in 36 amateur bouts, 50 professional bouts against 11 world champions, people like Muhammad Ali, Kenny Martin, Larry Holmes, Dwayne Bobic, and George Foreman. And I feel very honored to introduce Mr. Scott Ledoux.
Mr. Ledoux, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee giving me a chance to speak and bring this bill forward. I see a lot of familiar faces that I've spoken in front of in the last week and a half, and it's been very enjoyable. I have to commend you. My wife asked me about the process, and I said, you know what? Everywhere I go, I get different questions in every committee, and I think that's why it's in so many committees work so well to get a bill that comes clean and comes through this process. So thank you for all your hard work. I have, like I said, been around the game for 40 years, and I think that boxing is this commission really needs to be reinstated. Without it, we have a world champion in the metropolitan area that can't fight here. There are no boxing allowed in this area because of the no commission, and we have so many great fighters here right now. We have a couple young heavyweights that are very good. We have Jason Litzau and his brother Alan from St. Paul, and Matt Vanda. We have so many good fighters, Tony Bonsante, all good fighters that can't fight at home. And as you well know, home cooking is pretty nice. And so when you go on the road, in most cases, if you don't knock the guy out, you won't get a split decision. So you have to really do well. And so I've been part of that process. So I just want to thank you for the opportunity to look at this bill and bring the commission back. Recently, we had a boxing card about 2 years ago that was allowed here, and there was a fighter on that card who had 14 wins and 68 losses. And Jimmy O'Hara, who used to run the commission, I'm sure he was just spinning. He just couldn't deal with it. To think we would let a guy even come across the border with a 14-68 record. And those are the kind of things that we want to make sure doesn't happen. And along with that, people say, well, they're having fights at casinos. Well, those casino fights don't go on anybody's records without a commission. So that's the process that needs to be done, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Ledoux or Representative Westerberg? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak for or against this bill?
Yeah.
All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed to Mr. Ledoux's bill, say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, members and chair.
Representative Sikora. Chair will move House File 3131 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you.
There is an amendment encoded A06-1343. Members find that as a delete everything amendment. And Chair will move that amendment to get it in the shape that you want to discuss the bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Does that, everybody have that amendment? Just a minute until we get our paperwork straight. Line 1.1 says amends House File 3131, but at the top it, you have it? Are there any members that don't have it, the amendment? Okay, looks like everybody has it then. All in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I know you have a long agenda, so we will try to be fairly brief. This bill is about the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. They were formerly known as the EXUs, Education Cooperative Service Units, I believe that stood for. And by the way, the bill did pass the Senate Commerce Committee today also and was sent to the floor. The service cooperatives provide services to over 600 school districts, cities, and counties. The bill does two things. First, it enables the service cooperatives to provide health and health insurance programs, providing reinsurance or stop-loss coverage. Secondly, it provides for regulation and oversight by the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce. The Commerce Commissioner has approved the language of this bill. And the purpose of the bill is to reduce health care costs, and we will explain how that will be done. With me today is Dwayne Balkin, and Dwayne is the Executive Director of the Lakes County Cooperatives and Chair of the Service Co-ops Insurance Committee, and Bert Mackesy, and he's one of the people who's been working on the bill with me. So with that, I think I'd ask Dwayne to begin and to explain how we might find some savings in this bill and how we came to this.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Representative Wilkinson and members of the committee, I'm Dwayne Balkin, Executive Director of Lakes Country Service Co-op, located in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And for some 30 years now, service co-ops in Minnesota have been put in state statute to assist members in trying to do things more economically than they can do by themselves. And our primary members from 1975 to 1995 were school districts. And in 1995, the legislature also put in our charter to serve cities, counties, and other governmental units. So since that time, we've also added over 300 cities, counties, and other governmental units as members of the service co-ops on a statewide basis. And what our primary charge, like I mentioned, is to try to find economies for our members. And one of the areas that we've done a lot of work in over the years is in health insurance. And we're always looking for ways that we might try to do things to reduce costs. We've grown from in a voluntary pool from no members in 1985 to over 600 groups today, covering about 60,000 members. The bill that you have before you is one that we think also may provide our members an opportunity to save premium dollars. We've done a five-year analysis of the cost of stop-loss insurance for our pool members, and it looks to us like in that analysis there's some opportunity to go out and bid stop-loss insurance or reinsurance and possibly in the open market save our members money. In our analysis, in that five-year period, we paid for stop-loss insurance $120 million for our members. And with an estimated savings based on the claims paid, there should be around $45 to $50 million in that 5-year period that the carrier didn't have to pay out in claims. So we just think that if we were allowed to go out in the open market with stop loss insurance and do formal bid RFPs for stop loss, that we may have an opportunity to save our members additional funds in their premiums. So that's what we're proposing.
Okay, questions from members? Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair and to our guests, my understanding is that this is one of the more risky areas of insurance, and I don't see any limitations about sort of like how many lives you'd have to have or how big a pool. And I know there's a variety of proposals circulating about to potentially pull school employees out in different ways. You know, to what degree do you need to have some sort of a minimum pool to have to balance your risk? And will that ability to do that be threatened? Right now there's a lot of creative ideas going on trying to address healthcare costs, but I'm concerned that we might potentially have people taking on more risk than they can manage, particularly for maybe some of the smaller RFQs. I'm not sure. I'm not as familiar with them.
Okay. I think that's one of the reasons that we've had the Department of Commerce added as an oversight vehicle also for the process. But secondly, we're currently covering about 60,000 lives, 60,000 contracts, so probably 100,000 lives. Okay. Based on the current cost of what we're paying for stop loss insurance, our estimate is that we should be able to do it more economically in a RFP environment than we're currently doing it in the contract environment we're in now. To the tune of, when you talk about risk, based on the 5-year history we did, the carrier has paid out $72 million in claims. We paid $120 million for stop loss. Therefore, $48 million was left on the table. Okay? So, we see very little risk in the current process. But if you move forward with this, you have to have actuaries and underwriters do, you know, the actual charges for stop loss insurance. And secondly, the number I'm talking about is not one service co-op, it's 7 service co-ops collectively together that are proposing the reinsurance proposal.
Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chairman and Chair Guest, but I think it's easy to look back and say, you know, I can look back at the car insurance premiums I paid and said, wow, I could have done better without insurance because I never was in a car accident, but that doesn't guarantee that on the way home I won't be. And so I think it's always sort of assessing your other risk, and part of what we're doing is planning for the real likelihood that is being taken serious at all levels of government of a pandemic influenza. We've seen with Katrina how natural disasters can really suddenly put a community into a really different risk situation than they've ever encountered before. And so I'm not sure that just looking back is the best guide point in terms of adjusting risk, but maybe the Commerce Department could give us a little more insight as to what they understand of this market and how risky it might be.
Okay, we'll go to Mr. Maxey, and then maybe we can hear from Mr. Gross from the department. Mr. Maxey.
Mr. Chair, Bert Maxey from Lindquist and Bell. Representative, I think that the fail-safe here is the Commerce Department. We had 2 or 3 meetings with them involving about 9 people from the department just to get agreement on this language. And it's true that, you know, right now we're looking back, but I'm sure the Commerce Department, which is very tough on regulation and solvency, is going to be looking forward with us before they approve anything and let us go. So I certainly understand your concern, but I think it's probably a calculated risk worth taking to try and wring some savings out of the healthcare system. And that's about as much assurance as I can give you.
Maybe we can hear from Mr. Gross. Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Gross. I'm Director of Healthcare Policy for the Department of Commerce. I'm no expert on licensing a company, but I can assure you that if we're going to, in a sense, license anybody that's going to assume any type of risk, we're going to make sure that they're solvent. One of the things that we look at when we look at a company is the amount of risk they're assuming. The more risk, the more capital you need. It's called risk-based capital. And so I think that'll be the premise that the licensing section will look at when they look at any entity that's going to assume any type of risk, being low risk or high risk.
Representative Laughlin?
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, 60,000 lives, does that seem like a manageable group for a risk pool of this type? I don't know. That seems fairly small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lester, that I can't answer. I really don't know.
Representative Scott?
Mr. Chairman, it was 100,000 lives that are covered. 100,000 lives at 60 different contracts.
To that point? Yeah, list here.
Roundabout, wait.
Representative Atkins, Coles, then Rukavina.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, and I, my sense is that this may well actually make our insurance pools more stable by the fallback of reinsurance. In addition to my original question when I raised my hand was I wanted to make sure that it was voluntary. So I'm assuming school districts don't have the opportunity to do their own due diligence. Mm-hmm. But then another fail-safe, of course, is the department on top of that. I don't know that everybody will opt for it, but it seems like just one more tool in the toolbox as we try to make our health insurance premiums usable so we can still afford decent coverage.
Representative Coles?
Making an entrance?
Question for Mr. Gross, if I could, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gross, I'm looking at the language on page 2, line 8 through 10. Is that language that the department drafted or recommended? I guess this is maybe a kind of a multiple-part question, but I'm not sure which chapter of Minnesota law stop-loss or health reinsurance carriers are subject to. I'm wondering, I guess, the nub of my question is this language tight enough to make sure that the service co-ops, if we allow them in, are going to be subject to the same regulations as other insurance entities currently in the marketplace?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, it's this language we work with the cooperatives and Representative Sakura on, so this is language that we accepted. And I think the key word in there is regulation and oversight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gross, the other day when we were at Representative Bradley's bill on MSHA, I was telling you how I can, my constituents can't get the Department of Commerce to enforce the steering law in the state on windshield replacement. But the auto insurance is totally ignoring them, breaking the law. And when he calls up with actual cases of where people were speared, he's told by Commerce that we don't have enough personnel to enforce the law. So, how many FTEs have you been cut in your division recently? And where are you going to get the personnel to do this, this investigative stuff to see that you know, people are falling?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, one of the things that I've been with the Department of Commerce a long, long time. One of the things that no state insurance commissioner ever wants to be embarrassed on is a company going down the tube. So we have, I think, a real adequate staff to make sure that the company that we license is properly regulated. For example, any licensed company has to send to us quarterly statements showing their financial stability. They have to send us an annual statement. If we see a problem with any particular company, we're going to ask them for a monthly statement. So that's one of the things that we put a lot of emphasis on, a lot of due diligence to make darn sure we're not embarrassed in that aspect. Now, I apologize, Representative Rukavina. I didn't go back and talk to enforcement about your question on windshields, but I will do that tomorrow.
Sure.
Mr. Bowles, how many people have been cut in Commerce for insurance investigation?
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Riccadina, that I don't know, but there's been a number, yes.
Any further questions to the bill? Not. The chair renews his motion to House File 3131 as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members.
Representative Fox. Chair moves the House File 2485 be recommended pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Fox, I believe you have an amendment.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be the H-2485-82.
Okay, it's... Is
Mr. Chair, there's a little confusing thing with these amendments. The one, there's one that says on the top H-2845-82, and that is the wrong number, and so therefore it was given an A2 number which duplicates the real A2. So on that one we should cross out, and this is the one that says H-2845-82 at the top, we should cross that out and say H-2485-A3.
And the other one is substantially shorter.
Yes.
This goes to line 1.5. That will be the amendment that we move. And the chair will move that amendment to the A2 amendment for Representative Fox to get it in order you would like to discuss the bill. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You're moving the short. The short one.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Number three, the time stamp. Yeah, the time stamp is 03-2706, 10:47 a.m.
That's correct.
So if everybody has any questions, to get it in the order that Representative Cox would like to discuss the bill, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Cox.
I have one oral amendment on the bill. If you could consider that would be on page 2 in subdivision number 4. On line number 3, and it would be deleting the word may and changing it to must.
Okay, the chair will move the oral amendment on page 2, line 3. Strike the word may and insert must.
Correct.
I'm cold.
Mr. Chair, I'm still a recovering lawyer, but Mr. Pender, don't we say shall instead of must?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, yes, we do. Usually in this case where it's a ordering a person to do something.
I do like the statutes to read nicely. if Representative Cox would change that to shall, I'd be happy to support that amendment.
That would be fine with Representative Coles.
Yeah, yeah, the chair will take that as a friendly amendment, and it will be strike me, and it will be shall. Mm-hmm. Everybody got the amendment? All to the amendment, Representative Surge.
Representative Cox, there's a few other mays in there. Is this the only change you want to make in subdivision?
Yes.
Representative Cox.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Surge, yes, yeah.
Okay, any further questions to the oral amendment? Not. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Aye. All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill in its form now just deals with residential building inspections. We've deleted the part dealing with boiler inspections, so I won't go through that. Really what this is an issue relating to timing and keeping our building contractors working efficiently. A little bit of background. During holiday times, vacation times, just other times, when the municipalities aren't open and available, oftentimes building contractors do work.
And some of the days, for example, that would come into play on this would be oftentimes President's Day, Columbus Day, Veterans Day, the day after Thanksgiving, which is getting to be a common holiday, the day after Christmas oftentimes is. A lot of the builders are out working during those times. When we come to the point where we need inspections, we can't get them because the cities or inspection or the government units are closed. So what this bill would do would allow a building contractor to hire a certified private inspector to perform an inspection that you can't get, whether it's for cities just aren't staffed properly or there are vacations or whatever it is that's coming forward. In subdivision 1, you'll note that the builder would pay for the inspection, but 60% of that cost could be credited back to a builder if a sound inspection report is submitted at the time a new permit is applied for in the same municipality within 24 months. In subdivision 2, it's noted that the private inspection, ability to have private inspection, would really only apply to single-family homes. This isn't getting into multi-family homes or commercial work or anything like that. And it also does not apply to rental, mechanical, electrical, boiler, or pressure vessel inspections, or for the issuance of final certificate of occupancy. That would remain with the municipalities. In subdivision 3, that is the subdivision that authorizes the owner to have the private inspections performed. In subdivision 4, the Commissioner of Labor and Industry would certify the inspectors so that the inspectors would have the same force that the municipalities are using right now for their inspectors. And then in subdivision 5, so that nothing is lost in the tracking of the inspections, which are important to the construction of a home, any inspection that would be performed by the private inspector would have to be filed with the municipality within 10 days, and then a copy also retained on the construction site, which is fairly normal. And then no final inspection would be performed until any private inspection reports have been filed. And that subdivision, I think, is important, members, because it really maintains the custody of inspections and that the that to see that they're all properly done and the municipality has a copy of it. So that is pretty much a run-through quickly. I know you're busy here. But as I said, it was this is an effort to provide an option for builders to get work inspected. We want to keep them building, keep them moving forward. And really, through no fault of their own, oftentimes there are these vacation shutdown times, whatever. We get some cities, they get into situations where they send all the building inspectors and building officials off to seminars. Small cities especially, there aren't enough left there. And if you call for an inspection during this time, they just simply don't do it. They tell you that they're not available, they're closed, whatever. And this would give you an option when you're wanting to keep your work moving. As you noticed when I said some of these days, Veterans Day, day after Thanksgiving, day after Christmas, sometimes these are early times in our fall. Builders are working hard to try to get foundations in, trying to get projects enclosed for winter and so forth. So this would be just something that would allow them an extra tool. And I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Bill? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cox, I spent 35 years in the construction industry and about 25 of those dealing with architects and inspectors and engineers. And, you know, in that 25 years, I never, ever had a problem with coordinating my crews with inspections, having inspectors come on time. It really just takes a little bit of coordination, a little bit of planning. I'm amazed that there are actually still contractors out there that can't work around the city of Maplewood, for example. The inspector's not going to be there on a Thursday. They simply plan to have the inspection on a Wednesday or Friday. Could you tell me, do the cities all support this? And then I have one other question after that.
Representative Cox.
Representative Wells, Mr. Chair, thank you. Last question first. Nobody's talked to me from the cities on this at this point, so I couldn't tell you. Representative Howell's in Northfield today. The city has a regulation in effect that the city can back up to 48 hours before they hire in additional help. And this is trying to get at that. I appreciate that you've been spent many years in the construction industry. It's pretty hard if you're on a schedule, and whether you know it or not, other inspections have filled the schedule, and you happen to be number 46, hour number 46, so to speak, in the booking. You'll wait basically 2 days before you'll get something. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but when you're trying to get an inspection and beat winter weather or rainy weather or snowy weather, whatever's coming, that's a lot of time. And having an option to just simply call and get the inspection done immediately, for whatever reason, like I say, that it may not work. But there are a number of places where we are seeing some backlogs out there.
Representative Holt. Well, Mr. Chairman, my schedule's set here for the next 6 weeks, and there's a whole lot of stuff organized and taken care of. It sure would be nice if we could, you know, move something up a day or back a day or hire a private scheduler for our schedules. But that being said, my other question, and this is very important, if the city normally does the inspections and something happens, there's a lot, the inspector makes a mistake and there's a liability there, who's going to cover and insure and make sure that that liability is taken care of if this is a private inspector?
Representative Cox. Mr. Chair, Representative Halls, I'm not sure what liability you're talking about. Maybe Mr. Pender could help us if we can, but I'm not sure of any liability that flows through from the building inspector to the municipality other than, you know, criminal issues.
Mr. Pender, are you aware of any liability to the municipality currently? The inspection?
Mr. Chair, that would be subject to the limit on the statutory limit on liability that a municipality faces, and I just don't know what happens if you have a private inspector doing work that the city would otherwise do, whether that would who would be liable for that, I guess, because this is a new development, so I don't know. Ideally it'd be nice, I guess, if there were some kind of contractual relationship between the city and the private inspector, and then it could be dealt with by contract, that as far as who was going to subrogate or reimburse whom, but I don't know the answer.
That point, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have handled a case or two along those lines, and the answer is a firm I don't know, because it has not been litigated. This does not exist in Minnesota. The principles of sovereign immunity conceivably could apply, which raises the limits if you have to have some sort of contract. That's why it's bothersome that you don't have the cities participating in the discussion, is because without kind of a give and take about how the interaction would play between the immunities provided to the cities and the private contractor would be higher. Who knows? And I suspect you might be one that you want to think about a little bit more and tackle some of those issues before you just go headlong into it.
Thanks for clearing that up.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if somebody can answer that or not, but I'm not aware of any cause of action that's available for a building official doing the duties of inspecting work the way it is. I'm not aware of any, but maybe there are.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I won't belabor this anymore, but I'd like to a clarification on rules of this committee and deadlines. It's my understanding there isn't a Senate companion, so obviously this bill isn't going anywhere anyway, unless it's in an omnibus bill of some sort. But if the bill in this committee were not passed but laid on the table for further action so we could hear from the cities and hear from insurance companies, would that still allow it to meet the deadline?
I don't think so. I hope it doesn't pass by tomorrow.
Okay.
I've got a list. Was it to that point, Representative Vandiver?
Well, Mr. Chair, for the liability, we had an inspector in this committee last year from St. Paul who testified that they their liability didn't even include refunding the inspection fee if they made a major error or negligence. So it's my understanding that there is no liability on the part of the inspectors to the property owner for negligent inspection.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I think this is a real can of worms you're opening up here. Why are we choosing to allow them to make such inspections here? Why aren't you going everywhere on this? There's restaurants that can't open at night because they don't have the inspection. Seems to me like that's a whole lot more of an urgency than this. How can you say that this prevails over any other type of inspection, or why is this one area more important, or why do we break the mold that we have in all cases on this?
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulley, I would welcome people to look at those. I'm responding to some constituents that came to me with a problem and trying to create a method where they could alleviate the issues that had started to surface in the area.
Representative Mulley.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that suffices as a reason why we should break a standard that we have. But second of all, I have some other questions. You say a city can't reject any inspector. They may have a record with an inspector of problems, and you're not allowing them to do that. And another real serious problem I know with this is that, frankly, it's going to end up the same way as some of the other types of inspections that we have, such as the Truth in Housing. I've, as an attorney, sometimes they will tell me that things just happen to look okay if it's a realtor that sends them a lot of business. And why isn't that going to happen in this case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulley, I guess I couldn't speak to whether people want to get into some collusion and kind of things. I don't really know about that. All I just know is the bill is calling for the commissioner to certify the inspectors the same way that they certify inspectors now. If they're certifying somebody to do some work, they would have the same standards, the same licenses, the same. There is permit provision in here to post a bond, which is a little stronger. I don't think the municipal inspectors, when they're working for the cities, have to post, you know, personal bonds or anything like that, but there would be bonds in place if the commissioner determined that made sense. But I understand your concern, and I think that, you know, that probably can crop up in almost any industry. If there's favorable school teachers that look on students one way or another because their parents do something or whatever, I mean, I just couldn't really address that.
Representative Mueller.
But, Mr. Chairman and Representative Cox, that's why we're trying to have the city be neutral on this and trying to keep out collusion or anything like that. We can't just overlook the fact that it occurs sometimes or might occur in this instance, because that's why the cities are having their own inspectors. I don't see any reason why we should just throw out the fact that can happen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murray, I think the I'm going to take the viewpoint that people are guilty till proven innocent. I'll work with that one. And if the commissioner certifies somebody to do some inspections and there's some problems that are surfacing, I think, you know, the commissioner should take action on that and maybe remove the certification or remove them from the inspection list or whatever is necessary to be done.
Mr. Chairman, you said that there's a bond, but now what? That doesn't mean much. What does the bond cover on this type of thing? Since we don't have, I don't see anything in the language as to what the bond covers, and there's all kinds of bonds in the construction area, and a lot of them don't cover a lot of things that might pop up here.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, it isn't spelled out. I'm leaving that to the commissioner. The same thing that it isn't spelled out what the qualifications of the inspectors are. The commissioner would establish those and through a process and determine what is sufficient to be a private inspector like this, and let him move forward that way.
Well,
Representative Mulder.
Mr. New Chair. Or acting chair. Well, Representative Cox, I don't know how we're supposed to vote on something when we don't know what's being covered by the bond here. I mean, I've handled various types of different lawsuits on bonds in the construction area, and there's certain types of coverage, and a lot of times they can escape because the particular problem is outside that, and so it doesn't seem like we're being protected at all here. Even we're voting for something we don't even know what coverage there might be. And the other thing is that we don't know, or Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Representative Cox. What happens if the inspector is a corporation, goes out of business, and the bond is in that name? What happens? Is that covered by the Camacho case? Is it what happens in a bankruptcy? There's a whole lot of issues here that is not protecting anybody, whereas, well, I guess that's my problem. We're not protecting the person when there's a chance of collusion, and I'm very concerned that there's no protection on that. And what does the bond really cover when it's an inspection? Is this bond a guarantee that the house is built correctly? Because I don't know what kind of a bond you're going to have there.
Representative Cox, I'll let you answer whatever you want to there. Mr. Chair and Representative Mulroney, let me go back a second. I thought we were done with that, but I'm not aware of any cause of action against a building official or building inspector for guaranteeing that the house is built correctly. Unless somebody can direct me somewhere on a statute, I'm not aware of anything on that, so I'd just assume kind of put that aside. As far as the bond, the amount is not set in this legislation, and even requiring one is not set in this legislation. What it did is included it that the commissioner may require an inspector to post a bond if that's something that they want to do. And I should also point out, members, that there are literally thousands and thousands of private inspections that are done every year in Minnesota right now, whether you know it or not. In our community where I work, a business called Inspectron is hired to fill in when the city can't get to the inspections in a timely manner that I had set out earlier, if you consider 48-hour wait timely manner. These are private inspectors, and I don't know what relationship the commissioner has with those firms, but I assume it would be the same type of thing as in this. They come out to the job site. The only difference between the legislation being considered before you and what's happening right now is the city calls those people and sends them out, and in this legislation, the builder would have that ability to call those people. They're licensed, they're certified inspectors, and call those same people and send them out. So if this passed and went into law and I needed one, the first people I would call was the ones from the inspector, and I've gotten to know them, and they would probably come out. And it would alleviate the inspection problem.
I've got a question for you, Representative Cox. And maybe part comment. I live in Baxter. That's a very growing area, and I found that there are times that the city doesn't have enough inspectors, mm-hmm. and so they, with the number and volume of projects going on, they cannot keep up with it. And so it wouldn't be like Representative Howell's area, where a contractor can be very organized it's not a matter of organization, it's rather the volume of work. Is that where this is coming from, or is there something else that you're trying to get at?
That's, Mr. Chair, that's precisely what it is. Both, this occurs when there's both a volume of work in the cities that are handling inspections simply cannot keep up with the staff they have and need to bring on other staff. If they don't do that, then backlogs just grow. And it can be forced rather quickly by a change in weather, different things. All of a sudden, you know, their phones are ringing off the hook. I understand that. And then, as I said earlier, different vacation times, which are standard vacations for a lot of cities, are not for a lot of builders. The other issue is the, I suspect, again, that there would be most cities' inspection, they don't book inspections past 4 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot of these might be picked up by the slack by the same people doing the work for these cities. If there's an inspector that is working for a city, I would venture to say the commissioner would accept that as certification to be a private inspector also, and if they had proper insurance or whatever the commissioner might require, that then they would simply pick up some of these, and you might get an inspection at 6 o'clock or 6:30 or 7 o'clock, possibly in the evening, and the work would continue.
Representative Atkins, you still have a question? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cox. I just had a couple of questions on clarification. Subdivision 2, under Section 1, just talking about the unit of government. Presumably, we're also talking about counties here. I know it seems like today the entire discussion has revolved around cities, and as a person who has more to do in our district with how counties regulate rather than cities, I'm just curious as to whether they are included under that unit of government. And my second question just is, I was wondering if you could review a little bit about how the inspectors are certified, their process. I've had some dealings with septic inspectors in counties, and I'm just curious as to how this would follow, if indeed this would follow along some of the same lines as the septic inspectors have gone. So I'm just curious about the process. I'm concerned about, you know, the certification process. Our discussion earlier has been pretty much on liability, but I would just like you to address that if possible. Thank you.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Taylor. The certification process, first of all, I guess answering the who it applies to, it would be, I believe, it should be drafted so that it would include counties in that if the counties provide that service, inspection service. It isn't just municipalities. Not all. I'm not sure that all counties actually provide building inspection services. And then, as far as qualifications, again, the commissioner of labor and industry would establish what the qualifications are for individuals to perform these inspections, and be able, which would include a knowledge base if they want. They might require, as the bill identifies, they might require a bond, they might require insurance. They would just essentially establish what the criteria are. I'm not spelling it out. I wouldn't, as I said earlier, I wouldn't be surprised that the commissioner, if this moved forward, and one of the easy things to do would be to pick up people that are currently working in these capacities for cities and counties and just have those on the list to start off with while the commissioner looks at what other things are out there.
Representative Goodwin.
Oh, no question.
No question.
What?
Are there any other testifiers available that want to testify for or against this bill? Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief since the bill has been amended. My name is Brian Bergson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, 11,000 degreed non-managerial state employees. As the bill was originally written, it covered state boiler inspectors, but now it does not include them. It's still forced privatization, though, being pushed down on onto the municipalities. And it's a solution in search of a problem. Having represented the state boiler inspectors, they do a wonderful job. They're well-educated, well-certified, and our compatriots down in the municipal level, I'm sure, have the same qualifications and meet the same set of standards. And so we would encourage the members of this committee to vote the bill down.
Any questions from the testifier? Any other testifiers for the bill? For or against? Okay, seeing none, in Representative Wilkins' place, I'll renew his motion to pass as amended and be referred to the Federal Register. Representative Cox, closing statements?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to the last testifier, I don't in any way want to imply that, and this bill shouldn't imply that the municipal or county inspectors are not doing their job. I think they're doing, most of the ones that I've run into are extremely knowledgeable people and do a great job inspecting, but there are only 8 hours in their work day, and they are fully entitled to the vacations that there are in their work contracts. This bill really addresses those issues and doesn't mean in any way to say that they aren't doing a good job.
So again, recommended to pass and be as amended and be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion fails. Division has been requested. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed?
His ears are good.
It fails. Where are you saying that? Thank you, Representative.
Good dialogue.
Next, we have Representative Severson, House File 3561. Representative Severson moves the House File 3561 pass and be referred to Jobs and Economic Opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3561 is a very simple bill, just like we had in Commerce this morning and spent 45 minutes on. But I don't think it'll take that long this time. It was passed out of Commerce Committee, and it's before you now, and has to do with biotechnology and the increase in the number of zones within the state. About 2 years ago, we put into effect a bioscience initiative that established a bioscience zone in St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Rochester areas with about 500 acres. This portion of the bill is being initiated through a corporate gathering of people through the state area, St. Cloud area in particular, who have put together a bioscience initiative proposal. And this merely opens up the possibility for an additional bioscience zone. It does not designate the Midwest or St. Cloud area as a bioscience zone, but it does open up the opportunity for the commissioner to establish additional bioscience zones. And I do not have any testifiers. I'd be open for questions at this point.
Representative Goodwin.
Okay, I'm back.
Because of Representative Sellers' request.
It was banned over here.
One no one. Well, we heard this bill in the biotech this morning, so I really commend you for the speed at which you focus your bills through here and through several committees in one day, because I haven't had any such luck in 5 years. But in the meantime, I just wanted to talk about what happened there this morning, because there were several of us that had serious questions about this. And what we found out from the testifiers this morning was that when the $1 million was given to some firms in 2003, for biotech firms, there were nine small companies that got funding out of that. One of them moved back to San Jose, California, and the other eight, they say, may have created 50 jobs, but may not have created 50 jobs, and they may have created them whether we gave them the money or not. But there's only over 300 firms that could that are this kind of firm in Minnesota. So my objection then and my objection now is that we're picking winners and losers here, and we're saying we're giving money to people that just because their business happens to be in a certain area of the state, whether it be Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, or whatever. But we definitely are choosing between probably some very valuable firms that we'd like to encourage them all to be here. And the fact that we're trying to spend state money to pit one of our good little startup companies against another is just appalling, I think, because then we are helping some do better, hopefully, but the others are then at a competitive disadvantage. So at any rate, I think overall, generally, we shouldn't put any more money into this, and we should find more ways to encourage these businesses, and particularly when we invest in higher education and getting students an education at a reasonable tuition rate, and the tax breaks for all of our small startup businesses, regardless of where they are, and more help from our departments and so forth. But to just pick winners and losers here and say some companies are going to have a competitive advantage over other companies because the state wants to provide more funding or more incentives in some other way to you than to you, I think is going in the wrong direction. So.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Goodwin. I appreciate the comments. I think I don't know all of the specifics in terms of the 300 bioscience companies and the 500 medical companies that were in there. How many of those actually put in for the bioscience zone? I don't think it was all of them. I think those were the numbers that were given. And I'm not sure what kind of criteria the commissioner may have set to pick the winners and losers, if there were winners and losers. I don't know enough about those specifics. But this particular bill just asks for the opportunity to put in an additional, doesn't have any monies attached to it. It just says, you know, the commissioner can, if he chooses with his long-range training, long-range planning team, initiate more than one bioscience zone. That's all this bill is going for.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Severson for explaining that. But with no money in the bill, that money ran out for the project last year, we were told, early last year, and so therefore there's no money in it. So what do you hope to accomplish? And
Representative Severson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Goodwin. I think it's part of this is just to expand the horizons to say these are potential future options that we may have open. And with the other portion of this companion part of this bill, there was some monies that were associated with it, about $2 million that go into the mix for competing as well for some of those leftover funds. I believe that were from the other initial $10 million and $8 million were used, and this is the $2 million that is undedicated at this point. So if we go any further than that, Representative Goodwin, I can't give you an answer on it.
Thank you.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as we talked about in the Bioscience Committee, again, compliments to Representative Severson, and this allows for those who have an agriculture background or those in the ag community to not have a have to come down to Minneapolis or St. Paul or Rochester necessarily, but go where, in some cases, where the assets are. And again, just to be clear, Representative Severson, you did not put in the St. Cloud State, any of the schools in there, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Sellers.
So, Mr. Chairman, the actual zone could be anywhere else up and down the Red River Valley, northeastern Minnesota, wherever it may be, but it's just saying that if there is an asset out there,
yep,
and it's a bioscience asset, that we will allow that to be included in our grand scheme or grand plan for biosciences.
Representative Susan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, thanks for that. That's correct. This is more opening it up for, hopefully, the initial bioscience was for doing the intellectual property and the conceiving and the patenting of some new sciences, and this would open it up more towards the feet to the ground, more towards the actual implementation and training some of the workers skilled to do these things, to actually do the manufacturing.
Representative Mulder, you're next.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to comment, Representative Severson, that I don't know, I don't remember if you were here when the Job Z's went through, but it was specifically said that, for instance, while the urban areas would seem to need the Job Z's also, that they were getting the biotech instead, and the Job Z areas, the rural or greater Minnesota, wasn't going to get biotech. So now, basically, you're saying, well, yes, the inner cities can't have Job Z, but we're going to have greater Minnesota get the biotech. So while there is a trade-off initially, now you're taking one side of the trade-off and saying, oh, we get everything, but you don't get everything. And that just seems inappropriate to me.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Mulder, I understand your concerns here, and I think when we had the inception of the Job Z Zone, it was for those areas that were on the borders of other states where they were being attracted over the border from South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota, and from Wisconsin with some breaks in corporate tax rates, and there was a huge flood going over. We had a migration of companies that were just going over the border to take some of those tax breaks, and that was the intent of the Job Z. Now, as many programs go, that isn't always how it was completely executed, but that was the original intent. I remember I sat on Jobs and Economic Development when this was pushed through.
Representative Chairman,
okay.
Yes, okay. That is not the way that the Job Z Zones was explained to us. We had a long time, a lot of hearings and tax on it, and that was not it. It was not for border areas.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Severson, I think you've got a pretty good bill here, and I think people are reading a whole lot more into it than what's here. Members, if you look on page 1, line 9, it says the commissioner shall designate one or more. It doesn't say that the commissioner shall designate one in St. Cloud. It doesn't say that the commissioner shall designate six. It says one or more. It doesn't say that the commissioner has to designate any more than already exist. And if you go to the second page, it just talks about how the additional zones that may be designated are gonna come into place in the timeline. All that Representative Severson's doing, at least as I read it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Severson, but you're asking the department to create another bioscience zone that, while we may not have money for it today, we don't know how the budget's going to look when we get done on or before May 22nd. There may be money to do additional biozones. That's what your bill is doing. It's setting up the policy to allow the commissioner to possibly designate one more site. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, that's exactly correct. And I'd like to read line 1.7, 1.8. Basically, the commissioner, in consultation with the commissioner of revenue and the director of the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning, shall designate one or more biotechnology and health science industry zones. So it's, you know, we have put our trust in some of the people within the Department of Revenue and Department of Commerce to say, what are the most viable places that we can actually put these zones up throughout the state? And the way we've got it crafted right now, we're saying that basically that's only going to be Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. And we're saying that if in the future it looks like there are opportunities, as there are in Midwest Minnesota, with some of the agricultural issues that are formulating there, to increase that biotechnology zone or increase the purview of that, this bill allows that to happen. It does not mandate it. It simply allows it to happen.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, to respond to Representative Goodwin, I kind of let it go this morning, but Representative Goodwin, you're talking about why we're not doing more to help other businesses and all businesses across the state, but I recall vividly last year both Representative Pepin and myself had separate bills on increasing the research and development tax credit, something that would apply statewide to any business that's doing research and development. And you oppose that bill, Representative Goodwin. So Representative Severson's here with a little bit more of a targeted proposal that I think is a good idea and something that we ought to support. And when we were here with a more broad-based approach, Representative Goodwin, you opposed that, as did others on the committee. And so I'm not sure what you're looking for. If you're looking for broad-based, are you looking for something targeted, or you're looking for nothing?
Representative Goodwin, I believe that was a question.
I think it was. Thank you. I'd love to respond to that. Representative Cole, the credit you talked about was credit for money that we didn't have when we were attempting to cut 38,000 more people off of health care. That was my objection to that tax credit, quite frankly. And I've been on your committee, what there is of it. There was one meeting this year, and there was a handful of meetings last year. And I heard Representative Zellers talk about how this is part of the grand scheme of things, and I don't see a grand scheme here. We had one meeting this year. We had a handful of meetings last year. Not a whole lot came out of what we had. I have not seen a master plan for biotech and bioscience and building this, and I'd love to see that. I would be right there with you if we do have an overall plan for improving business, and especially biotech and biomedical businesses in this state. I'd love to see it. I haven't seen your plan. If you have a plan, I'd like to see it.
Representative Coles, you want to comment? And eventually, let's get back to the...
Representative Goodwin, every time we've come forward with an idea, whether it's a master plan or a single idea, you seem to oppose it, and I haven't seen your master plan or any idea from you or members from your side of the aisle on the Bioscience Committee. We did have a good bill that we're going to have up next from Representative Mahoney that we heard this morning. Maybe you'll oppose that too, I don't know, but I happen to think that Representative Severson has a good bill here that maybe isn't doing as much as you'd like to see done, but it's doing something. And I'm pleased that he's here doing something instead of just complaining that nothing's getting done.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I speak into a microphone, but I don't have one here. Representative Goodwin, in my committee, if you were asked for it, I'm sure we'd love to have you there. But we heard a lot of bioscience things this year. In fact, our committee in the bonding proposal put $27.3 million in our bonding priorities. In fact, it was number one in both caucuses. And if you want to hear about a plan, Representative Mahoney is our bioscience expert in our committee, and he has just informed me that they're working hard on getting some kind of plan developed between the university and Rochester, and I have every confidence in him getting the job done.
Okay.
But we are working and talking about bioscience very often, and I know Mulry couldn't stand me talking about it.
Representative Gunther, I appreciate that, and we're going to be hearing from Representative Mahoney next. But Representative Mulry.
Oh, well, just to give Representative Mahoney the warning, I was just going to ask how many doctorates he has in biotechnology, since Gunther has established.
Feisty crowd tonight, Representative Gunther.
He's got a master's degree in life.
Any other testifiers that would like to testify for or against this bill?
Can we have Phyllis?
No. Well, any closing comments, Representative Severson?
Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate the discussion. I think that we all know that Minnesota's moving forward with a bioscience initiative. I think it's what we need to be competitive on a worldwide basis. We have the agricultural assets. We have the intellectual property. This is a piece to the puzzle, and I would appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Severson moves that House File 3561 pass and be referred to Jobs and Economic Opportunity. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Except for you, Van Deer.
Representative Mahoney.
Boy, are you in for a wonderful day. Come on down.
Well, and Representative Zeller, that could be fine. I've got a multitude of witnesses if you'd like to hear them all.
Seriously, Bemidji Biotech, one of those guys.
Representative Gunther, would you like to move the distinguished Representative Mahoney's bill?
I certainly would, Mr. Jeremiah. I'm going to move House File 3185.
I believe it has to go to civil law because it has gotten...
Civil law.
I know, I don't really want to go there. I have to go there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I believe it was amended in the...
Which one?
The biotech subdivision, so passed as amended.
Thank you. Members and Mr. Chair, last year, it was actually about a year and a half, was brought to my attention that when you have a biotechnology company come to the state of Minnesota, there, and they are building a plant, those prints have to go to a municipality to be okayed in their inspection, not a housing inspector, not a private inspector. The problem with that is it becomes public data, and when it becomes public data, the competition can come and request that particular information. They can look at the process that it's being done. It's not like an oil refinery where an oil refinery has, everyone builds an oil refinery the same way. Biotechnology, it is not the the product, but it is the process that they need to trademark and keep confidential. So, last year the House and Senate passed a bill that required the Department of Labor and Industry to get a committee together to come up with a solution. They met several times over labor and industry, and this bill is the solution. The biotechnology process piping system becomes non-public data. When it's submitted in support of an application, this all involves all the data when it's submitted in support of a building code permit. It doesn't say that all the permit stuff is private data, just the actual process piping. So if there's high pressure steam or there's process water, any of that stuff still stays public data. It's just the actual process for the bio product. This bill also makes it part of the bioprocess piping, part of the ammonia piping and the high pressure steam piping inspection division. And it was chosen to go there because they've done these kind of inspections before. This bill also prohibits any local government from charging a permit fee for bioprocess piping inspection when the state is doing it, so it's not double processed or double charged. And that's about it.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Mahoney, I think this is a good bill. I'm going to support it. It's maybe not... we maybe don't have a grand scheme yet, but I think it's one. I do think it's a good piece of the puzzle, to use Representative Severson's phrase. Thank you for bringing this forward. I know there was a situation in Brooklyn Park or Brooklyn Center last year, and this is going to help our biotech companies as they continue to hopefully grow and expand here in Minnesota. And without protection like this, members, they're simply going to choose to go elsewhere, because Representative Mahoney's absolutely right. It's the process that's at least as important, if not more important, than everything else for these companies. So thanks for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifier? Testify for or against this bill. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. The only concerns I have is usually they go by, there's a trade secret provision in state law 1337, which is different than a regular trade secrets. And so what happens when information is given, a company or whatever, you look at 1337 and you see where the public interest is and where the company's interest is to make that type of stuff non-public or confidential, or whatever term you want to use. Non-public is the one. One of the concerns I have is, with all this being closed, is who is making sure that the people who are, whether it be the building permit, which is done by the locals, or by the state, who's overseeing them to make sure that this is safe and sound, particularly when you start looking and hearing about things of living organisms. Those are some of the concerns I have, and one of the things is, at least with some information, you know, how this is done or whatever, without giving the trade secrets, I think, it can be open, the sunshine or whatever you want to call it, or the new term, what's the new term? I forget what they use now. Transparency. See how old I am? All those things have been around. But that's the concern I have. This is the first time I've seen the amendment. There's a lot of things during in the rush of deadline here, but at least those are some points of concern I raised. Thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. And Representative Mahoney, you want to comment about that at all?
No?
Okay. Any other questions? With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 3185 pass as amended and be referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, committee members.
Oh, he forgot to tell us about the grand plan.
Moving right along. Representative Severson, you are back.
Still looking for final appraisal.
You want to move your bill, Representative Severson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 2921 for as amended.
What do you mean?
Actually, it needs to go back to state government finance.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, members, I have a verbal amendment I'd like to put on before to get it in the shape we need to discuss it, if I could.
Proceed.
On page 1, line 1.23, right after the word grant, towards the end of the sentence, insert up to 10 working days of, and then on line 25, after the period, delete, leave must, and then delete lines 126, 21, and 22 on the following page.
I got the first one. Could you repeat the second one, please?
On line 125, after the period, after service period,
yep.
Delete the leave must, and delete lines 1.26 and lines 2.1 and 2.2.
Okay, Representative Severson's oral amendment is on line 1.23. Yes, Representative Laffer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, does this potentially conflict with the family leaves, medical leaves of absence, because you addressed here the issue of an injured family member, and I think that under the federal Family Medical Leave Act, they'd have actually access to much more than the 10 days that you've narrowed it down to. So there might be some tension points here in the case of an injured.
I think we'll have Elizabeth Long answer that. Or do you know?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, and this and the Family Leave Act is a federal act, and that would take precedence over this statute for businesses that are 50 employees or larger.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if our council would want to add on just a little language then that says that this doesn't supersede, rights under the Medical Leave Act. Because I can just see this written up in some summary of business obligations, and some employer might misinterpret it.
Ms. Long, can we have you address that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, in Subdivision 4 on page 2, beginning at line 5, well, beginning on line 6, nothing in this section, and then continue down and look down to line 8 there, or otherwise affects an employee's rights with respect to other employment benefits. So this is not intended to disrupt FMLA leave.
Okay.
Representative Loeffler, are you comfortable that this is in order?
Mr. Chair, I always trust the advice of our good counsel.
Okay. All right, so Representative Severson's oral amendment on line 1.23 after grant, insert up to 10 working days of, and then on page, or line 1.25, after service period, delete leave must, and then delete line 1.26. On the next page, delete line 2.1 and 2.2. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's in the shape you want now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. This is the governor's veteran bill, and it's quite a piece of work. It's very comprehensive, and it's got some great provisions in here. This particular provision is for, it's not that kind of piece of work. The leave for immediate family members, military personnel injured or killed in service, and one of the issues that we've had that has been brought forward to the governor is when family members are injured or killed while in service, we do our best to try and make sure that the families are able to get to, if they are injured, to get to the hospital, typically on one of the coasts, and be able to be with their soldier while they're recuperating. Part of that provision is put into the requirement here. And as was previously stated, for those companies that have 50 and more employees, they go under the Family Leave Act, which allows them up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave absence. For those 49 and under, this particular provision would be taken into account. And what we've tried to do here is strike a balance for small businesses. Obviously, for small businesses, the people are going to have a closer working relationship. There is not going to be that separation you have from the supervisor to the person down there who has this tragedy happen in their life and then has no one to really talk to. Typically, in those smaller businesses, the main employer or the CEO knows those individuals, and we would hope that in this particular situation, they would have the compassion for their employers to say, take as much time as you needed. And that's how this provision was previously worded. We're feeling like that was pretty nebulous, so we've ended up putting a 10-day period in here, which would be 2 days on the front end, 2 days in the middle, and 2 days on the other end, which would amount to about 16 days of total leave time. And we've done that to try and strike some leeway with the business sector. The small businesses, obviously, this puts them into a bind, and it's not always a comfortable thing to do. But our hopes are that this is a friendly compromise, and I would ask Colonel Shields if he would possibly come forward and testify to this portion of the bill at this time.
Good evening, Colonel Shields. State your name for the record. And by the way, I like the new outfits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's like wearing pajamas to work sometimes. We have some other things going on today, too, so I apologize for not being a little dressier. Colonel Denny Shields, I'm the assistant to the Adjutant General, Department of Military Affairs. As Representative Severson so eloquently pointed out, small businesses throughout our country, particularly here in Minnesota, are bearing quite a large burden as our National Guard, as well as other military organizations, are involved in an operations tempo that really we've never seen for some time. We've had, over the last years, we've had anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 of our Army Guard soldiers over in Iraq. We've had two cases that really come to my mind where this particular bill would really, really apply. These are young soldiers who were severely injured in Iraq, and the medical authorities who were taking care of them felt that it was in their best interest to have their immediate family, in these two cases, their mothers and fathers, out with them for a fairly long period of time. Now, the federal government pays for their transportation costs. The federal government puts them up in a nice place out in the Washington, D.C. area. The federal government pays them per diem so that they can eat. But it does not make them whole in terms of their jobs. And, in fact, this bill alone won't do that either. But there are some great organizations in the private sector. I'll name one, the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, that exists just to help families out in situations like this, whether it's helping the small business employer pay for the health insurance while the family is away in a leave without pay status, or whether it's helping with some bills. More is better in terms of a leave situation like this, to be perfectly honest with you. But certainly we can accept 10 days, mm-hmm. Understanding that it's just a huge burden on our small businesses, and we've been much appreciate the support that they've given us over the last couple of years here.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Anybody else want to testify from the audience, for or against? All right, that Representative Severson renews his motion that House File 2921 pass as amended and be referred to State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. All right, Representative Abler. Where's this going? I'll move the House File 3283 pass and be referred to civil law.
Thank you.
Representative Abler, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, it's getting me a long day here, so I won't take too much of your time, but in short, this is a bill that, remember last year we passed a bill that allowed for people to buy long-term care insurance to protect their assets if they have such insurance. What we passed last year was a really great bill. It allowed 2 tiers. You could have a little bit of coverage and protect dollar for dollar, or you could buy 3 years of really good coverage and protect your entire estate. The feds got involved and kind of gave us the best of both worlds. If you buy a really good one, you can save dollar for dollar. So it took, not the way I would have done it. But anyway, so now we have to conform our law to that. And this bill does that. It talks about training of agents. It talks about information for the customer. It talks about the first Article 1 is really just kind of how to go about with some, in my mind, relatively minor conformities and agent training, which is not a minor matter, but it's pretty technical. This Article 2 is the one that's got more meat in it, and part of that's is what takes it to civil law. It has to do with recoveries. And Mr. Chair and member, he's ever left here. There's two parts of recovery. There's two parts of the estate part. The one part that's at the beginning is the eligibility. So when you spend down, when you exhaust your benefits, you're then allowed to apply for medical assistance. And under medical assistance, you're allowed to have $3,000 of assets. Let's say about a $100,000 policy, and you burned up $100,000 worth of appropriate charges in your long-term care, you're allowed to have $103,000 of assets and still qualify for medical assistance. And then you go into that program. And then when the estate gets taken care of, when the person finally passes away, they're allowed to protect that same $100,000 in assets from any liens incurred by the other person who bought the coverage. So there's something we're working on which is more germane to the civil law, I think, but just, it's not resolved yet. And maybe I was talking to Mr. Rubenstein today. What I'd like to do, and I don't know if it can be done, is to set it up so that if you have $100,000, and you have to allocate your assets. Let's say a house is worth $100,000. So you can then say the house is my $100,000 worth of what I'm going to protect. You have to decide that when you burn up your money and apply for medical assistance. What I would like to do, if it could be done, would be to allow that the house would then, if it's valued at $100,000, would then remain frozen in terms of value and not go up to the value. Because I'm afraid, and just so you know, as an author, it's my intent to work on that with whatever it might take as this goes through the process and in the conference committee, to allow that. Otherwise, if the house, the person's in care for some time and the house is up to $200,000, now you only save rescue $100,000 worth of value, and the estate sells for the $100,000 that's appreciated, which means you might lose your farm, or you might lose the house, and the family has to pretend to buy it. So otherwise, the family has to pretend to buy it when the guy goes in the nursing home. And so we all pretend that it's not, and it's people will do it, I'm sure, and that way you'll lock the thing in. I'd rather just do it straight up. And I encourage the department to think about that people will be doing churning and all that to qualify. And this will be another estate planning tool. First month they will do that. I hope we can just make it.
If I get to that point, because that's probably my main question I had for you. I think it's line, page 18, line 32. It says it does not include the increase in value of a protected asset and the income, dividends, and profits from the asset. And my question was going to be, is that federal guidelines that are requiring us to do it this way?
You might ask the department if they're here.
Is there anyone from the department here that can testify? If you want to step forward and state your name for the record and let us know.
Is your department?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Gross. I'm the Department of Commerce.
Where are we at again?
Page 18, line 32. But this is a federal requirement. Where the,
so when the assets are determined...
The inflation is not protected. Like they establish an asset for so much and the inflation goes on, they can lean against the inflated value above the base.
You got to state your name first, though, what you're thinking about. Pardon me. My name is John Gross with the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Oh, the entry. If a value is something, is that on page 18, line what?
Line 32. Basically, okay. As you guys are thinking
the
about it.
The increase in value. Is that a federal requirement? So we're going to work on that.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer.
I'm pretty sure
to come up in a meeting today. So this is sort of a work in progress. And,
yeah. You can proceed. I love the bill, but go ahead and proceed.
Anyway, so do you know the answer to that question?
With the DHS question.
Yeah, and DHS is back. Yeah, I think, go ahead. Yeah. You're out of here.
Thanks a lot. Mr. Gross, thank you for your comments.
You know,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Selstad, and I'm with the Department of Human Services Aging Division. And the rationale for not reflecting that inflated amount is that there would be a reduction in the estate recovery that exceeded the dollar-for-dollar value of the partnership policy and would require a fiscal note if it were forecast within the fiscal note range. For purposes of this initial legislation, with the likelihood of any estate recovery being many years out, we do not have any programmatic fiscal note on this.
Okay.
But it would become a factor.
And so,
Representative Mabler,
ask the witness a question. So this is a state choice, not a federal requirement.
Mr. Chairman, Mr.
Abel,
yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, this is an obvious amendment for the Health Committee, as it was going next to, and I respect the need to recover, but I also want to make, I'm concerned if you don't make this enough of a benefit. So if you can get a house, $1,000 house here in the thing for, that way you can keep your house, you have to do all this stuff, which people will do. And that way, this will draw people into the program. Because the more who come to this program, the more people are drawn into long-term care insurance. The long-term savings are enormous. And I think far more than what little nickels and dimes will be lost on these few people that spend down. You want to get, because long-term care insurance is used by probably one person in four who buys it. You just don't know who that one person in four is going to be.
Yeah.
So. And Mr. Chair, just a little humor here, if you'd like. The fiscal note in this bill, which they've kept down so well, is only $2 million, most of which is for a health match, 4 months delay. So that's meant to be a little humor. So the fiscal note has a little work to be done on it yet. So.
Representative Mabler,
lucky they kept it down for us, Mr. Chair.
I can't figure out how you got $2 million. And my bill to try to do something for seniors was $20 million. So
they like
you did
better.
A good job.
Yeah. Anyway, so there is an amendment. Is that ready to be passed out? Was that copied?
Yeah.
Or is it being copied?
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Do we have the amendment?
Yes.
And Mr. Chair, what this amendment says, and there's at least this will put a placeholder in the bill. My goal in this entire bill is to make sure, for one thing, that the agents, the training they need. So that's really fundamental. Like this is kind of complicated. You got to jot all the T's and dot the I's, right? I also want to make sure that people can do it, so that it's safe for the consumer to understand. But I also want to make sure that it's worth something when they get it. I want to keep the state bars the barriers to making this a really good product. As low as they can be. And so that you'll see in some of the languages that we conform to the federal standard on training. So at least that keeps the bar as low as it can be, and that hopefully will be changed with time. There'll be more training in the first years, and later on those have refresher courses and so on. So that's my intention, and I think the department understands that, and they've been very good to work with, so I want to commend them too. The amendment you're getting, Mr. Chair, I've discussed it with some of the hallway some of the lobbyists from the plans, and they can talk about it if you want. But the problem is, if you had a qualified, the standards for a plan to qualify are relatively high. If you were wise and bought a plan 5 years ago that qualifies with the federal standard, And this goes into this new, this will go into effect right here, July 1st is the target date. They'll amend their plan end of September, or submit a plan, which will be retroactive to July 1st. Your plan that you bought, you've been paying for all this time on, that does not give you the protection for your estate. And that to me seems like silly. And so what this amendment will do, it will require a carrier to rewrite, to reissue the same exact policy you got, Senator, put a new cover of a piece of paper on the front. So there's new policy on the front. Brand new policy, and all other terms will be the same. If you don't have a qualifying plan, that doesn't, then you have to re-underwrite and all that. But if you've bought, if you've been like the good little aunt and been diligent and been underwritten in a proper way, and your plan would have gone forward, but for that, it still could go forward anyway, you just wouldn't get the protection. So there's no reason to penalize people with that. So, Mr. Chair, with that, if someone would move the amendment, and then you can talk about it.
Okay, I'll move the amendment, even though I have some reservations about it at this point. Let's see if there's any testimony for or against.
Dangerous. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dominic Spizzetto. I'm here representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors of Minnesota and also the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents. One of the issues that we have with the partnership program is that the federal statute said it only applies to policy sold after the effective date of our plan amendment. And after we pass this legislation, we will have to, as a state, submit a plan, an amendment to our Medicaid plan with the federal government. And generally that takes 30 to 60 days, maybe longer. But then the policies that were sold previous to that wouldn't qualify for the partnership. And we were hoping there would be some mechanism that we could come up with as a state to either convert or reissue or give people an opportunity who have taken the responsibility of buying a long-term care product prior to these partnership products and have the availability of a partnership type product so they could get the same benefit. Now, I don't know how we get there. I'm not sure the language of this particular amendment is the way to go. I'm not sure how to do it. In fact, there may even be prohibitions in the federal government that we may not be able to do that. It's something that we think, though, deserves attention and should be researched, and that we can hopefully figure that out before this bill goes on to the governor's office.
Any questions for members? Representative Gazelka.
So, Mr. Spizzetto, what is your position on this amendment then?
I would like to do something like this, but I'm not sure this is the way to go. I think it mandates that companies have to do something they may not want to do. I would, looking at the federal statute, I'm not sure there's specific language as it relates to exchanging policies. And there's some language that says that if you exchange a policy, the benefit for the partnership is based on the previous policy, not the exchange policy. But that may be covered in the amendment if it has to meet the requirements of the partnership product in the first place. I'm not sure how many policies out there that will actually meet the requirements of the partnership product because of the specific requirements that they have for inflation at certain age brackets. But there obviously will be policies that will have a significant value, and it'll be difficult for us to figure out how to convert that. So I would prefer that we have some sort of authorization for the commissioner to authorize conversions or reissuance without any specific criteria at this time until we can figure out what we can do with the federal government.
Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Abler's desire to make sure that people that have long-term care insurance policies already that meet all the requirements get something out of it. So, you know, I appreciate your wisdom, and I'm hoping that we can address something. And if we don't, then I'll carry some legislation down the road to do that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
So perhaps if members could put this amendment on today as a placeholder, indicating that we want to try to work on this topic. It seems like if you don't put the language on, it doesn't get discussed. This has a long ways to go. You know how I work. I'm not going to cause any harm to the robust long-term care insurance market. Lucky guess. Anyway, and so this has to go back to health.
and the fiscal note would be dealt with there. This will wind up probably going into omnibus, I would guess, if there is an omnibus. It would go in as almost an appropriation. It differs significantly from the Senate version. The Senate is of a nature that they like to have their own versions on things. So there will be a conference committee, I would predict, on this topic. Last year there was. And so that would be my promise to the committee.
Okay. Further testimony? Please introduce yourself.
Use the word robust.
You already used it.
Vital, sorry.
Vibrant, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We wholeheartedly support the long-term care partnership. We're very enthusiastic about it. We have concerns about Representative Abler's amendment. We pledge to work on this issue. We understand that there are the insurance industry advocated in Washington to get all long-term care policies grandfathered in to the long-term care partnership program. However, there were significant state budget concerns with that approach, so the federal government did not go in that direction. We are, however, allowed to exchange policies, and I know many companies do intend to do that. And we will work with Representative Abler on language, but we prefer not to have this on at this time. One, because it mandates that companies do it, and two, there's absolutely no time restriction on this. So if I bought a long-term care insurance policy 20 years ago, and now I'm about to go into the nursing home, we can't change any of the terms or the premium for that policy despite a significant change in circumstances. So while we really think it's important to address, you know, for folks that buy a policy now or bought a policy a year ago or maybe even 2 years ago that won't have a partnership policy, we think it's important to get those folks in, but there needs to be some reasonable parameters on that. So we would be very happy to work with Representative Abler and Representative Gazalka, who's also expressed concerns about this issue, and the agents, but we would prefer to do it in a more collaborative manner.
Hey, Representative Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to hold you to that.
I have no doubt you will,
questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from members? Representative Watson.
Mr. Chair, members, sorry, I'm juggling between two committees here, so maybe this is addressed in the overview, but does this limit us from authorizing other types of long-term care insurance to be authorized? That, you know, anything that's related to long-term care will have to meet this, or only these type of policies will be recognized in terms of the offset?
Is it to the bill or the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry, this is to the bill.
Okay.
So
well, go ahead and answer it real quick.
To get the state protection and the Medicaid eligibility, you have to meet the criteria. Otherwise, you just have long-term care insurance just for its old purpose. This gives them more benefit having long-term care insurance if your plan qualifies and was written after July 1st of 06.
Further questions?
Is there language?
Seeing none to the amendment, Representative Abler has some concerns on this, too. So at this point, I'm going to withdraw the amendment and just suggest that we work together and anyone else who's interested in work together. Between here and health, and see if we can come up with some acceptable wording.
Super. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions to the bill? Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair and to Representative Abler, I don't see just quick whipping through this other than a reference on the policy to people being referred to the Sanger Linkage Line or Department of Commerce, if there's really anyone who's charged with putting together consumer advice on the advisability of buying this. I was struck by, and I see Mr. Hastings from the Department of Human Services here, I went this fall to a number of seminars or briefings that the Department of Human Services had about anticipating sort of the needs and the economic needs of our seniors, and I was struck by how many are not going to be able to meet their basic living needs, let alone, you know, in terms of being able to save up sufficiently for their later years. And their ability to do that may be distracted if they're putting a lot of money into long-term care insurance and not enough into sort of meeting basic food, shelter, other costs planning as they're making financial choices in their 40s or 50s. And maybe you could address that and whether or not, how you see those two things. Is there a consumer advisory process, or do we need to look at that in a different, vehicle?
I didn't catch your name because I came in after you spoke.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Selstead, and I'm with the Aging Division of DHS, Representative Loeffler. The senior linkage line and the various educational aspects of the area agencies on aging and others would be making this new law and this partnership program known to consumers across the state. There is, both within the advocacy for older adult protection as well as the suitability provisions of 62S, some protections that people should not be sold inappropriate policies for their situation.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Selstead, does the suitability address sort of their full financial picture and their ability to balance the premiums versus other costs?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, John Gross, Commerce Department, Representative Loeffler. Minnesota has very extensive amount of suitability requirements by the agent and the company to make darn sure that this product is suitable for the consumer. For a lot of people, long-term nursing care product is an asset protection type of device, but it should never ever be sold to somebody that truly doesn't need it, that, you know, let's say is near medical assistance or anything like that. There's no way the agent or the company could get by with that.
Further questions? Any further questions? Anyone else in the studio audience wants to weigh in on the bill? Seeing none, who made the motion? Representative Gazelka renews his motion at House File 3283. He recommended the pass and re-referred to
Civil Law.
Committee on Civil Law.
Do I have to go there?
Sorry, I'm down there all night. You can come on down.
Begging mercy again, Mr. Chair.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Member.
Representative Simpson. Hamilton.
Aye.
What?
Come on.
The layup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I can't imagine why everybody left with this exciting piece of legislation here in front of us, but
hold on while we get organized.
Certainly.
You may have you help vote.
I need to move reconsideration of the last motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move reconsideration of the last motion where we sent that civil law. We're just sending it to help. There was some confusion here. My error. So,
any discussion?
Good thing we took the gavel away.
No discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I move that bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health Finance.
Any discussion?
3283.
Pardon me?
House File 3283.
Right. That one.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. Motion carries. All right. Representative Simpson, need someone to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. If you would, please.
I guess I could do it.
You could, you're on the committee.
I would like to move House File 3747, and I do have an amendment that I would also like to move. The House file or amendment is labeled H3747A1. To the amendment.
Hi.
Okay. Simpson moves the H3747A1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author is looking for. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, over the last couple of years, the major oil companies have put in volume requirements for stations. If a station owner doesn't do the volume, they lose the national brand sign. In some areas, jobbers who buy enough to supply several individual station owners have developed a local image, which several of their owner customers want to put up. Because of an interpretation of existing language in the franchise law, this local image is treated just like a McDonald's logo would be, with all the expense and paperwork of compliance. What this language would do, as amended, would take these local signs out of the franchise law, 80C, and put them into the chapter covering petroleum supply agreements, which is 80F. The Department of Commerce, who enforces the franchise law, supports this bill, as well as the jobbers and station owners. And I'm not aware of any opposition, and I will stand for questions if anybody has any.
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, it appears to me that this is good consent calendar material. I do this support of consent calendar.
Any discussion on Representative Gunther's motion? Okay, so move this to the consent. What's that? All right. Representative Gunther moves that this be referred to the consent calendar. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Okay. How's that? This is one awesome committee. Especially the six or seven of us that were tough enough to stay.
No, I think it has a lot to do with the chair.
Yeah. Okay.
What's next?
Nothing.
Okay. Make a move to adjourn. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. Motion carries.
Start the committee again.
Oh, we can recess? Oh.
There's some confusion over that Abler bill.
Simpson.
Oh, okay.
Simpson.
So, what's Dean, the motion then?
Dean, come in quick. We got to make another motion quick.
Consider each other.
Make a motion to reconsider. House file, do I have to make a motion to reconvene?
I suppose so.
Make a motion to reconvene the Commerce Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. For reconvene. What's the motion? Okay. Make a motion to reconsider House file 3283. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All the same sign. All right, the chair will make a motion to re-refer House File 3283 to the Civil Law Committee. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, make a motion to adjourn. Motion adjourned.